Well, welcome everyone. Welcome to Mindshare. I'm here with Ellen.
Hi, Anne. Hi, everybody. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year, everyone. So this might be your first live Mindshare with us. If so, we want to welcome the 50 plus new Mindshare members that we have. And so just to kind of give you some guidelines on how this works with this Q&A call, at the bottom of your screen, you're going to see a couple different boxes. One is Q&A, and then kind of to the far right, you'll see a box that says chat. Please use the Q&A and not the chat, just so we don't have to go back and forth trying to, you know, figure out what people are asking. At the end, we always save time for your live questions. We do have a list of questions that were posted to the forum. If you do have questions, we encourage you to post that. And that gives Ellen and I a chance to kind of look over your questions, decide who's going to answer what, you know, really dig into the who's, what's, why's, and how's of your questions and really give you really thorough feedback on those questions. And what we always do when we start Mindshare calls is we start with what we're excited about. So how about you, Ellen? What are you excited about?
Well, it's a little bit self-serving, but what I'm really excited about is actually the Mindshare presentation that I'm doing next week for our January monthly Mindshare. It's my turn, and I'm doing a deep dive into supplements and quality issues around some of the types of supplements that we use. And I put a lot of work into it over the holidays, and I'm really excited about it. It's a good presentation, so I hope you'll all join me and find it as useful and interesting as I have.
Awesome. Awesome. We're super excited to see it too. There's so much to talk about with supplements and quality of lines and ingredients. And so we're really glad that you're doing this and we can't wait.
Yeah, I had to narrow it way down because there was a lot you could talk
about. I bet. So I have so much to be excited about. It's hard for me to determine what one thing I want to say, but I guess the next immediate thing is that this weekend, I have a group of girlfriends and annually in January, we go away and it's this weekend and we're going to go out to the California coast. And it's just a time where we have a lot of fun. We take long walks on the beach. We do vision boards for the next year. And I'm really looking forward to just, you know, being with these women who have been in my life for a really long time and have such great relationships. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
That sounds amazing.
So let's get started. I have the first question and it's from Emily. And Emily says, I just joined Mindshare and I'm working to navigate my own state laws. She's in Wyoming as she sets up her practice. I'm not sure if I have access to a previous Q&A call that is referenced having just joined. And actually, no, Emily, we've given you three from the past, but that's really all you'll have access to. She said, I would love to either have some reference or renew this discussion again to learn more about navigating nutrition practices in more restrictive states. It seems there is a big role that semantics and language play, but I would love to hear from others' perspectives. Has anyone out there started a practice in a red state per the Council of Holistic Health Educators? So Emily, determining your ability to practice within various states is really not something that we get into since we require some sort of nutrition certification to take our programs. We really assume that all of the students that take RWS classes have done their individual vetting to determine their own individual ability to practice within their state. And it really depends on whether you're in a state that's strongly controlled by dietitians or just restrictive. If it is a state that's strongly controlled by the dietitians, then we really recommend that you advocate for yourself and your fellow nutritionists with your state legislature to really help turn the tides. I also think becoming board certified with NAMP and if you have a master's degree or greater, joining the American Nutrition Association, that can be of great value and just really, you know, kind of cement your own credentials. And then make sure that you keep your nutrition certifications up to date at all times. So, you know, don't let your basic, like if you graduated from NTA, make sure that you keep that current, keep your RWS certification current and that kind of thing. Above that, I know that we have graduates in some of the red states. So go to Facebook, you know, and post this question, because there are people who live in those states. I don't. And Ellen and I both live in California, which isn't as restrictive. And so go to the Facebook group, the private RWS group, and just post that. And I know that there are people that have taken our programs that do live in those states, and I'm sure they can be of help to you. Also, kind of attached to this was a question from Lisa, who said, pertaining to this question, can you also talk about being a health coach? Is health coach a suitable title for a restorative wellness practitioner? Or do we need to get another special training in order to be called a health coach? So Lisa, health coaches are different from nutritionists in that health coaches have a limited knowledge of anatomy, physiology, pathways, nutrient requirements, and supplements in general. They really don't work with supplements. Health coaches focus on almost exclusively supporting change with a client, you know, really getting to the bottom of what's blocking them from being able to achieve their goals. And they do that by asking open-ended questions, being non-judgmental, and laying out the steps that will really help their client achieve their goals and be successful. This is really something that we do teach in the Restorative Wellness Solutions program. So you can definitely include health coach in your repertoire or as part of your own self-description. You know, while we do focus on more of the clinical, we do get into a lot of that in level one, how to, you know, really develop strong relationships with clients. So I think we are health coaches in addition to being restorative wellness practitioners. Ellen?
Okay, our next question comes from Gina. Gina says, I currently have a client who follows a paleo-ish diet and exercises regularly. However, her lipid panels are elevated. I'm wondering if this particular client is a saturated fat hyper-responder due to her elevated LDL levels. I'd love more information about such individuals and if there's a certain percent of saturated fats they should have a day in order to monitor their cholesterol levels. So Gina, this is one of those, you know, like I got more questions than I have answers. But I think, you know, for example, you don't see what her lipids looked like before she started eating this way, or if this is a newish way for her to be eating. So we don't really know if this is a new thing for her, that you've seen a change in her lipids. And you also don't tell us what elevated is. You know, is that by your estimation using like the functional ranges that we teach? Or is that her doctor's statement, who we very often don't agree with when it comes to lipid levels? So, you know, there's kind of a lot there to unpack. Remember that LDL is the lipid that, I love the way Rhonda Nelson says this. She says that LDL stands for leaves deliver, which is an easy way to think about it to remember. LDL is the cholesterol that's leaving the liver, being sent out into the periphery because there's a need for it, whether the body needs it to make hormones or deal with inflammation or perform some other sort of task out there. So if LDL is her only marker out of line, you know, in particular, we really want to dig deeper. So what's going on? Why does the body need this? How's her gut health? How do her hormones look? Does she have any chronic injuries or chronic infections? And then the other thing, of course, that we think about is how is she doing at breaking down and absorbing the fats that she's eating? Lipid metabolism certainly has something to do with all this. So there really is a lot to think about. You know, if you work your way through all of that with her and you still don't really have a very clear picture of why perhaps this is a change that you're seeing, you could always have her try changing her diet. You know, try reducing the saturated fat that's in her diet for a few months. Have her eat more of a paleo Mediterranean type of diet and then retest after 3 months or so and see if it makes a difference. You said she's eating paleo. So I don't exactly know what that means and how clean her diet is. There really is no set percentage of saturated fats that we would recommend, everyone being so different in this area. But, you know, you would just really want to make sure that the rest of her diet is very clean, no sugar, no refined grains, and that she's eating lots of fiber to help her appropriately bind up and move out any extra cholesterol.
Excellent. So this question is from Ishbel. And she asks, how much time do you generally spend on one client outside of their appointment time? I'm finding that I'm spending 3+ hours preparing an initial protocol, and what she's referring to is developing a protocol for the GI map and MRT. I'm sure my time expenditure will go down as I become a more seasoned practitioner, but in the meantime, I'm feeling like the amount I'm charging for my time isn't enough considering how much time I'm spending on protocol development and email and text support. Thanks for your input. So this is, Ishbel, this is something that we all face when we first start out. You know, it is a lot of material to wrap your head around, and you want to make sure that you're doing everything right and that you're not missing anything. And so, you know, it will take an extraordinary amount of time initially as you're learning this way of working with labs and developing customized protocols. It's going to be labor intensive at first. And this is really your investment in yourself and your own expertise. And it's not really something that you can charge each client for, because it's your learning process. And because of that, you know, it really wouldn't be fair to charge each client to pay for your learning. That's my belief anyway. The other thing that I would say is, what are you really doing for 3+ hours? Because it does seem like a lot of time. You know, I could see maybe spending an hour really going through the markers on the GI test and making sure that, you know, you have a full understanding of how to explain that properly, looking at the protocol, healing solutions sheets, putting that together, and then looking at the MRT and listing all of your high grains and foods that aren't, you know, included on that. So I would need to know, like, what are you really doing for 3 hours? Because it does seem a little bit too long. I'm wondering if you're going down Google rabbit holes and, you know, are you really honing your process and staying super focused on here's what's presenting and here's what I need to do to address that in a very concise way? And sometimes that can take some time as you're looking at, okay, I have bacteria, I have yeast, I have a parasite, you know, what can I use that will kind of cover all of those bases in the most eloquent way possible? So that's kind of how we always think about it. What functional supports does this person need? What does the microbiome look like? And, you know, once you do that a couple of times, you're just gonna get really good at it. And you're gonna go, okay, my go-to formulas are this, this, and this. Regarding the email and text support, it really depends on how you structure your fees. You know, if you charge by the hour, then that hourly fee should be high enough to include your support, your email and text support, or you just basically have to charge the client when you email them and text them. I mean, that's just fair. So you either have to have a high enough fee that you know you're gonna include that kind of support and not charge for it, or you have to charge for it. We think that a far better way of handling that is to charge in a package, you know, whether it's a 3, 4, or 6 month package, you know, however you like it to work. That one time charge that covers all of your services for that given period of time includes all of your time in appointments, all of your time in emails, tech support, looking at the labs, and you feel good about that amount, so that you're not going to feel resentful. You know, that's kind of how we think about choosing our fee schedule, is, you know, what feels good when I think about charging this amount. Charging once up front then takes money completely out of the picture, and clients aren't reluctant to schedule ongoing visits with you because they've kind of paid for that, they've included it already, and you get to be successful even through the hard parts where they're sick of taking supplements and maybe they're not sure if it's working yet. You can get through that bump because they've kind of paid you up front for it. So we really think that's the best way to go. And it also means that when you've gotten that payment up front, you shouldn't have any angst at all about heartfully giving yourself over to answering those texts and emails, you know, in that loving, giving way, because that client has paid you in trust up front. So Ellen, do you have anything you want to?
No, I would agree with everything that you said.
Okay, perfect. So Ishbel, I would just say, you know, sit with it and decide what feels good to you. What do you feel really works? And part of the mastermind that was back last year. This is the way it works. And you know, for all of you new grads, this is kind of what we believe is the way to find your fee. Is you decide whether it's either an hourly rate or it's a package. You sit with it, you think about it, about how much time is involved with your work that you're not charging directly for, or if it's a package, how many appointments that potentially would include and email and text support, and then sit and think about, pick a number and think about that. Does that feel good to you? Does it feel too low? Does it feel too high? Or does it feel just right? Then go up $10, $15, $50, $100 and sit with that. Does that feel good, low, or too much? And in that way, you can kind of find that sweet spot of what exact amount feels good based on your level of expertise, your experience, and how confident you are that you can really help that person.
I love that happy price tool. I use it all the time. You know, when you go too high, you feel yucky. When you go too low, you feel yucky.
Yeah.
It's a really good way to find what feels right for you. Awesome. All right. Our next question was from Stephanie. And it's a multi-part question about blood work. And she starts by asking, can you please help me understand thyroid readings? So she's got some bloods back here where T3 total, T3 free, TSH and FSH, which is not a thyroid hormone, are normal, but T3 uptake is high, and T4 total, free T4 index, T4 free, and LH, not a thyroid hormone, are all low. She says that this kind of feels like a mess to her and that she's on armor and bioidentical hormones and would really like to get off of those. So, Stephanie, I think I remember correctly that you have not taken level 3. And so I'm going to sort of answer this in that manner. We go through all of these markers in detail in level 3 and how to interpret patterns and what it means, with the exception of FSH and LH, which are actually brain hormones that have to do with cycling sex hormones. And we talk about those in level 2. But overall, you know, what you're describing here is a picture that, like many times, really needs more exploring. Your tests or the results that you've shared here don't say anything about thyroid antibodies, which are always an absolutely critical piece of the puzzle to help us understand if there might be any autoimmune composition going on, which can really change what we think and what we might do. And you also haven't said if these markers that are normal based on what the lab is saying, or if perhaps using our functional ranges, which tend to be more narrow and more precise, might really not be normal, or are they lab low, or are they functionally low? It all really means something. And because some of these markers that are appearing normal on the lab test might actually not be so from a functional standpoint. So, you know, just a quick understanding of what these hormones are. TSH, also not a thyroid hormone. It's a brain hormone, where it's your brain releases to stimulate the thyroid to make T4, which is inactive hormone. And then the body turns that T4 into T3, which is the active hormone. And then there's the free versions of each of these. So there's a lot happening here, and there's a lot of places that stuff can go wrong. So, you know, in order to be able to look at thyroid panels and go, yes, it's this, we need a lot more information than sort of what you've preliminarily provided us here. And I'm going to repeat this recommendation later for you, but you know, really recommend if you haven't taken level 3 that you spend time working with a practitioner who is really very versed with these numbers, because it's complicated and there can be a lot of different things that are going on here. So Stephanie goes on to say that she's on day 1 of a 5-day water fast. And based on these thyroid labs and the wonky hormones, in our opinion, is the extended fast a good idea? Again, you know, not real easy to say without knowing anything else about you and your symptoms, your complaints, your presentation. But generally speaking, a water fast or any type of an extreme fast like that can be pretty hard on a system that's struggling, you know, especially let's say if there's blood sugar issues that are feeding in and contributing to the thyroid and the other endocrine issues that you might be dealing with. So, you know, just the restorative wellness standpoint is we never undertake any kind of a detox program before we are sure that the foundations of digestion and blood sugar are very well managed. And only then would we consider it. And even then, a 5-day water fast is a bit more extreme than the way we tend to work. Then Stephanie goes on to say, further on her bloods, what could be the root cause or insights into low hemoglobin, total iron, percent iron saturation, and ferritin all low, but iron binding capacity high. So again, there's lots of things that could be behind each of these markers being out of range. But very often when we see a pattern, just like you're describing here, low hemoglobin, which is the protein in the red blood cells that actually carries the oxygen and the iron, and low iron, percent saturation, and ferritin, it's often a picture of iron anemia, all of those things together. The iron binding capacity, which is also known as TIBC that you mentioned, is what's called an inverse marker. So it goes up when iron is low. So it actually fits very well into the rest of that slight pattern there. The last thing that Stephanie asks or says is that she's had high ALT, which is a liver enzyme, and low white blood cell counts for years now. So again, we really need to dig. Something's causing some damage to the liver cells and the release of these enzymes. And something's challenging your immune system chronically, whether that's a bacteria or a virus or a parasite. We don't know. So we would ask, have you done a GI map recently? Low iron and low white blood cells, that could easily be coming from some sort of a pathogen that's in your gut. But again, we'd need a lot more to really be better able to figure all this out, and would really recommend that you hook up with somebody who has a really good in-depth understanding of all these markers.
Excellent. So this question is from Christina. And Christina asks, I was wondering if anyone has heard anything derogatory about Megaspore. Some of the doctors in my area have been telling clients not to take Megaspore Biotic. A colleague of mine had contacted Microbiome Labs to see if they had any information as to why some of the doctors would be cautioning our clients away from this product, but he hasn't gotten a response. Is there any information, or has anyone heard anything that could be helpful, or any information as to why some of the MDs are cautioning their patients or our clients away from it? I know my colleague has done some research and found that there is a potential for antibiotic resistance transference. Any insight would be helpful. So we haven't heard anything about potential antibiotic resistance transference with Megaspore Biotic at all. And I did a preliminary Google and nothing came up on that either. There have been those who have worried about the bacillus spores in Megaspore that they could grow out of control or not perform as they're designed. Over the years, we've been working with this product and we've seen absolutely no negative issues. And we have hundreds of practitioners using this product and nobody has ever reported anything negative. Megaspore itself, the lab, also has dozens of studies behind it showing dramatic in vivo results with tremendous safety. Clinically, we all find it gives us really robust results with our clients and none of the potential negative reactions we often see with the more traditional probiotics, you know, like the lactobacillus based only, and those that are also really poorly tolerated with SIBO. We recommend rotating probiotics after the initial therapeutic period, which is usually 3 months or so, so to gain benefits with a wide variety of strains and mechanisms. But we do continue to feel confident recommending Megaspore, as do many other major thought leaders in functional medicine and nutrition. And places that you can click on to find more information about this would be healthrebeltribe.com, AllisonVickery.com, Chris Kresser, HumanLongevityFilm.com, and that's Dr. Grace Liu, who specializes in the gut, and DrJillCarnahan.com. And then other health leaders who support the use of spore-based probiotics include Mark Hyman, Dr. Jolene Brighton, and Dr. Joe Mercola. So I think it's pretty well accepted in the holistic world. And I think that there still can be MDs that are fear-based and, you know, just dismissing something without really understanding it. I've had clients who have questioned the use of both spore and soil-based probiotics out of fear. And honestly, it seems completely unfounded. Megaspore and Kiran Krishnan have many webinars on YouTube, and we would encourage you to learn more about the product and how spores work on those YouTube videos.
know, and I would just add, I think this is one of these places where we're literally all just sitting right on the edge of, you know, what's new. And it is still the Wild West when it comes to the gut. And there's new tests showing up every day, and there's new probiotics showing up every day. And, you know, we probably know one thimbleful of all of the information in the universe that there is to know about the gut. And maybe one day we won't be using spore-based probiotics, but we certainly think, and all these other thought leaders as well, just think at this point, they're very clinically useful.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a question from Anne, who needs some help with a blood panel to make sure she's addressing the issues that her client is having. And she did attach this blood panel for our reference. So I'm going to read you the summary that Anne has written, and then I will give you my comments without really going directly into the blood panel itself. So what Anne says about her client is that he eats fairly clean. He's clearly sympathetic dominant and a night owl. He doesn't have trouble falling or staying asleep, but just doesn't get enough sleep, 5 to 6 hours at best. He has a lot of joint and low back pain. When he's nervous or stressed, his face becomes flushed with red blotchy spots when in front of people. He's tried many modalities to reduce his pain and the red blotchy spots, acupuncture, hypnotherapy, traditional medicine, etc. A year ago, he did an MRT and a GI map, and it revealed shiga-like toxin E. coli, H. pylori, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and Streptococcus species, and two different types of worms, the Nicator americanus and Tinea species. His elastase was low at 239, and his SIGA was also low at 405. He also had a high calprotectin at 57. So he had a lot going on. She put him on an H. pylori and dysbiosis protocol and other supplements to help with intestinal health and what was showing on his blood work at the time. Anne requested a retest of the GI map as soon as he finished the protocol, which he has yet to do. He ended his protocol in February of 2019. During this time, he went to his medical doctor as he was concerned about the results of the GI map, and the doctor told him the test wasn't valid and ran a traditional stool test, which showed nothing unusual, making Anne's means of working with him that much harder. A couple of weeks ago, he finally went and got his blood work done again as he was feeling so lousy, but he told me that he didn't have time to do the stool test. Very frustrating. As you can see, his lipid panel is very elevated, which was the case the last time, which is why I added on some additional cardiovascular markers onto this test. His free T4, T3, and total T4 are elevated. Vitamin D is very low. And inflammation markers like HSCRP and homocysteine are very elevated. As Anne says, clearly the body is on fire. His white blood cells depressed with only monocytes being elevated. His anemia markers are elevated, speaking to dehydration and B12 folate deficiency, and his ferritin is extremely high at 344. Anne goes on to say, what confuses me are the additional cardiovascular marker. His lipo-A, which is a hereditary marker, is extremely high. His apo-A, which is a good guy marker, is at 183, and his apo-B, which is kind of a bad guy marker, is okay. The ratio of good to bad is still okay. And then she tested his LPPLA2, which falls within the reference range. So it has to do with the buildup of plaques. Basically, she added on some very advanced cardiovascular markers to try to get a deeper look here. And then Anne goes on to say, if I follow the RWS protocol to address the high cardiovascular issues and other areas of concern, is there something else I can do for the lipo-A and to raise the APOA to APOB ratio? APOB ratio, please advise. Okay, Anne. So when I first looked at this, I thought, oh my gosh, I need to go so deep into each of these cardiovascular markers. And then I stepped back a second and I said, hang on a second. This is a very classic situation that you have going on here. So what I would say to you is that your client is really lucky to have you. But what I really should say is that he's going to need to figure some things out if he's going to continue to have you. Because this is one of these situations that we just, you know, really preach to not encourage with your clients. Clients who discount your advice and take that of another practitioner instead, but then expect you to help them with certain pieces here and there, are clients you're just never going to get anywhere with, basically. You know, he did a map a year ago that had some heavy duty infections, two different worms, a variety of inflammation. And it sounds like there's no reason to expect that he was compliant and that things would have resolved, especially since his doctor told him that he was fine and discounted the map totally. So here you are 11 months later and you've got blood work that's showing you he's highly inflamed. His D is low, his HSCRP, homocysteine, ferritin, and uric acid are all high. His white blood cells are low. His monocytes are high. His lipids and thyroid, and most probably his sex hormones, are going to be out of whack if you tested them as well. You know, basically every system of his body at this point is just being compromised by his unwillingness to heal his gut infections, optimize his digestion and absorption, work on his stress and sleep, lower his inflammation, and basically just listen to you, right? You know, this is the kind of client that we really have the come to Jesus talk with. This is someone who it can be really effective to say to him something along the lines of, look, I know what to do to help you reach your health goals, but unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to work with you if you're not willing to do what I recommend, because you're wasting both of our time and your money. In situations like this, a kind, firm hand can really go a very long way to helping them see that they're blocking your ability to be effective. You know, you're just not going to be able to get results. As for his cardiovascular markers, you can't really worry about these until you get him foundationally healthy. You know, it's like deciding that you want to install new cabinets when you haven't even poured the foundation of the house, right? You're not there yet. Certainly, if he, you know, if he's bought in and he wants to do the work, some methylated B vitamins would be very helpful. Putting him on some omegas, getting him on some vitamin D with some added K2 for its cardioprotective properties would be a great idea. Get him on a fiber supplement to help, you know, bring the lipids down, and maybe something else to lower some inflammation as well. And absolutely a GI map retest. And, you know, if it was my client, this would be my line in the sand. You know, these are the things that we're doing, or unfortunately, I'm just not going to be able to help you. Anne, do you have anything that you want to add to that?
Go, Ellen. That's exactly what I would say. And, you know, it's really, it can be so difficult because we want to help people. And yet, you know, he's wanting to dismiss the importance of the retest on the GI map and go downstream. And you can't ignore the healing priorities of the body. And so, Anne, I would just say, you got to be strong and you got to decide, do you want to work with him and does he want to work with you? And, you know, we support you 100%. Okay, this question is from Ellen. She has a client that did a comprehensive blood panel and she needs HCL support and increased protein and some methylated B vitamins. Ellen is not sure how to deal with thyroid panel, with her thyroid panel. She has a TSH of 3.1, so heading into a hypothyroid presentation. However, her free T3 is 4.1, which is the upper end of the functional range. So showing some hypo and some hyper tendencies. All other values are normal. Not sure how to address this or if I need to. So Ellen, assuming that all of the others are values are normal, including her antibodies, that I would say that the free T3, that elevated free T3, can be a sign of iodine deficiency, which would fit in actually with her hypo state. It's just that it can, that iodine deficiency can kind of falsely elevate that free T3. So you might consider doing an iodine test on her to confirm, provided she doesn't have those elevated antibodies. And that scenario I've seen many, many times. It's really not all that uncommon. Ellen also has a question about a 60-something female Hashimoto's client who did her first GI map, and her main issue was dysbiosis. She did a full protocol with biocidin and all of our recommended supports plus Megaspore. The retest came back with three species of opportunistic bacteria, Bacillus species, Streptococcus, and she did another protocol with monolaurin plus dysbiocide with all the supports included. And during that protocol, she added adrenal and immune supports plus calcium D-glucarate. She did a third follow-up map, and this client still has Streptococcus and Bacillus plus a new one, Pseudomonas. Ellen says her protocols were very comprehensive and she just doesn't feel like she can put her client through another GI protocol. She also worries with the autoimmune that she will never get well until the bacteria is gone. Her last blood work did show evidence of potential viral and bacterial issues. This client's GI symptoms are virtually gone, however, so this is good. On her test, the enzyme looked better and the steatocrit is back in range. Her SIG-A is coming up close to normal, not quite though, and beta-glucuronidase came down 700 points, not quite into normal, but heading in that direction. She also did a biohealth postmenopausal panel with Carr and will be consulting about how to address that. Ellen says it's just so disheartening to have to tell her that the bacteria is still present. She's done everything perfect, and I can't understand why the bacterial overgrowth is not resolving. I do not think she or I have done anything wrong, but how to explain this? How to keep her trusting me? Thoughts? What am I missing? So Ellen, you haven't done anything wrong and your client hasn't either. This is all about biofilm. And so what you've said that's so, so important in all of that is that your client feels great digestively. So remember, we never go by the lab alone. We've always got to take into consideration the progress or lack of progress made by the client. So trying to get back a squeaky clean GI map is kind of like trying to get back an MRT that shows zero food sensitivities. It just doesn't happen. With the map, there are so many things to consider. You know, what is her diet like? Does she eat organically? Does she get enough fiber to feed the beneficial bacteria to crowd out those opportunistic strains? What are her stress levels? What about her hormones? Estrogen dominance may be a factor with that elevated beta-glucuronidase. So it's good that you did the biohealth hormone panel. After two rounds of digestive work and with a client who feels great digestively, it's just fine to be satisfied with the results. So in these types of cases where you're still seeing some presence of bacteria, you know, and what I would say is that if it's just the bacteria, and not is it just bacteria, because if that's what presents on an initial GI map, we're going to go after that. But I'm saying as long as there aren't any big, bad, ugly parasites or, you know, real dysbiotic bacteria like the ones on the first page present, then I would say that what you can say to the client is you've made such great progress and you're feeling great. Let's just plan to do another GI map in a year and see where you are then. And that then tells your client that you want to monitor the situation at some point in the future, but it also frees you up to move forward with the next level of healing. And so, you know, I would just communicate to her that very rarely does a GI map come back with absolutely no dysbiotic bacteria at all. And you know, it's something that can kind of shift rather quickly. So make sure that she's eating enough fiber, that, you know, she's on a good probiotic, and that, you know, make sure that she's eating low carb and eating organic and all those things. And then that lets you move forward on the whole, what's the next level with her Hashimoto's. So that's how I would suggest handling that.
Perfect. All right. This is our last pre-submitted question. It comes from Grace. Grace basically posted a very long discussion that had taken place on a Facebook pregnancy and postpartum group. And so I'm going to summarize it rather than read the whole thing. So essentially this post is about an RDN who specializes in gestational diabetes, who made a post saying that it's a myth that blood sugar levels trend higher in pregnant women than they do in non-pregnant women. And she cites a review study that looked at 11 different studies comprising a total of 225 women, which found that glucose concentrations during normal pregnancy are actually lower than the current target numbers used, which suggests that the normal range for pregnant women's fasting blood glucose might need to be lowered. There are issues with the methodologies and confounding factors across each of those 11 studies, which the authors do point out. So Grace goes on to point out, very rightly so, a few additional key issues, including the fact that fasting blood glucose is not the most reliable way to look at blood sugar, as it really tells us nothing about how blood sugar responds to food, peaks and valleys throughout the day, possible deep hypoglycemic swings overnight, any things like that. And Grace, we totally agree with you. You're right on and good thinking about this. This is why we always want to see the broad panel of blood sugar markers. And we do talk a lot about this in level 3. This includes things like hemoglobin A1C, fasting insulin, possibly even C-peptide, which is a measure of insulin production, and fructosamine, which is a 2 to 3 week average of the blood sugar. Fasting blood glucose is often the last marker to become dysregulated. So that's really why we need all of the others to determine what might be creating a picture of gestational diabetes or really any sort of blood sugar imbalance. Grace goes on to say that this same RDN recommends a pregnant woman maintain a fasting blood glucose of about 80 as an ideal target, which Grace rightly notes is a good target for just about anyone, really. But again, just remembering this test isn't the only thing that we're going to look at to ensure that somebody has balanced blood sugar. It's not at all uncommon to see perfect fasting blood glucose numbers and the other numbers horrible when you start to dig into it, and people with all sorts of energy issues and all kinds of things like that. So when it comes to the gestational diabetes test, which I believe is what probably generated this entire discussion, you know, everyone in our community realizes there's a huge issue around this, particularly when you're dealing with clients who you already have eating really good, healthy, low sugar diets, and then you send them off to take this huge bolus of sugary solution all at once, which is indeed a real shock to the system and is probably not going to reflect somebody's true metabolic capacity. I know that there have been people who have worked with midwives or very enlightened doctors who've been willing to let them, for example, monitor their blood sugar with a glucose monitor multiple times a day for a couple of weeks and bypass doing the gestational diabetes test. So that's the summary of our thoughts on the long post. Anne, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No, I think you handled that perfectly.
All right. Well, we have quite a lot of live.
Here. Let's dive in.
Go in the order they
ask. I've been taking calcium D-glucarate for over 3 months since I got the results of my GI map. Do you suggest I stop taking it now or continuing it for now, even though I'm not able to redo my GI map right now? Stephanie, we would say stop it. You know, you don't want to continue taking any of those formulas, whether they are antimicrobial, antiparasitic, or the calcium D-glucarate without retesting. So if you've completed your 3 month protocol, go ahead and stop.
Okay, and Lenny asks, personal question here. Loose stools, especially during menstruation, is still an issue for me since November of 2018. I did a GI map and MRT. I had my protocol approved, but that issue persists. It's gotten better, but it's not gone, and I'm not sure what the next step should be. So, Eleni, you know, have you retested? How did the retest look? That's one of the first things that comes to my mind. During menstruation, by the way, really common. So the prostaglandins that give you cramps they act on muscle, and so they increase peristalsis in the intestines. It's really common to have loose stool during menstruation. But yes, yeah, certainly would want to know about retest and what's showing up there as a first step.
Grace asks, where does hypoglycemia fall on the fasting blood sugar range? So Grace, we would consider anything less than 75 on fasting glucose to be hypoglycemia.
Sorry, I'm just typing all these into our list here. Jessica says, I'd love to hear more about how restorative wellness practitioners charge their clients and what kind of packages they set up. And would also love to hear what's done in their first couple of visits. I'm having a hard time trying to figure all this out. So everybody's a little bit different, and there's kind of no one particular easy way to answer this, Jessica. I think, you know, a few things that I could suggest to you. I think this is a great topic for discussion on the Facebook group. I think you'll get a lot of play there, and if you search, you probably can find some discussions that have taken place around this. You know, if you are really stumped and needing help with business things in particular, you know, there's always mentoring, right? And Anne and Margaret really specialize in working on business type of setups. But just realize there's so many different ways to do this. And a lot of what Anne was talking about earlier with the happy price comes down to it, and just really figuring out how you want to structure things in a way that's going to work for your client base. So we're all a little bit different. And I know that's not a very precise answer.
But it's true. Teresa asks, related to the question about state regulations, I know you all work with clients remotely. Can you see clients that live in red states as long as you live in a green state? So Teresa, yes, you can, but it's still, you know, it's very much a gray area. You know, where is jurisdiction and all of that? So we all do. But I don't actually know what the law states about that, because I don't know which state has jurisdiction, the state that the practitioner lives in or the state that the client lives in. So
I'm certain it's the state the practitioner's in. It's just like if you have a medical license, it's only good in your state, but you could still, you know, virtually practice with somebody
who yeah. I mean, we've all done it for years and it's never ever been an issue. So
Jessica is referring back to the question we had earlier where she said, I'm also taking 3+ hours on client preparations, but I think it's because I'm also looking at the NAC and the initial interview forms, et cetera. Is this still too much time? You know, if you've been doing it for 3 years, yes, I think it's too much time. But if it's something that this is all still new to you and you're still working your way through, you know, each of those things is going to take some time. You will get faster and you know, have more practice with it. Just like Anne said, you know, you don't have to look up every single marker on the NAC, right? Always be thinking about patterns. And that's really what we talk so much about in all of our classes. You want to be thinking about patterns. Where are you seeing trends and not chasing down each individual marker on a blood panel or, you know, answer on the NAC. Try to step back and see the forest for the trees.
Katrina says that she's been reading some things about spore-based probiotics causing problems. Also, how do we know that the spores are opening up in the gut? And also, are they opening in the small versus large intestine? Thoughts? If you read and trust what the manufacturer is saying, that they do open up in the large intestine. So that's kind of all we have to go on. You know, we don't have the ability to do like an intestinal biopsy and really see what's going on there. So we're like you, trusting what the manufacturer says.
I think what they're saying about the spores, in addition, is that they withstand exposure to all the digestive juices, and so they're just alive and functional until they hit the large intestine, which is their target area.
Yeah.
Molly goes back to ask about packages again. This is a short question. She says, do you charge upfront or in monthly installments? And I would imagine, again, it's everybody's a little bit different, but I can tell you, for example, and I know Margaret does the same way, it's either. If people pay for their package upfront, I give them a small percentage off discount off the total, and I know Margaret does the same thing, or they can split it into 3 monthly payments for the whole price. And do you do it similarly?
I don't take monthly payments. I just charge one flat fee. It's a fee that I feel comfortable with. And I want people to be paid before we start, so that I don't want anybody waffling or going, okay, I'm done, I'm not going to retest. It's all stated up front. They agree, they pay, and everybody follows through. And it seems to work well. Teresa says, I apologize for not sending my questions in advance. I hope there's time to respond. One of my clients started having joint and muscle soreness after 2 weeks on the full dose of biocidin and olivirix for bacteria, dysbiosis, and candida. I recommended to cut down to the biocidin to half, one before each meal, and the symptoms subsided. Now I worry that it will not be enough to eradicate the pathogens. Do you recommend trying to get the dose up again or switching to another eradication agent? So Teresa, I think you've just, you know, really stumbled on a real deep core aspect of that bacteria potentially, you know, being in the joints. It's either that or he's got some sort of reaction to one of the ingredients in biocidin. The only way to really find out is to try slowly titrating back up. If it's a healing reaction and the joint pain was because of that, then you should be able to ramp up and he won't have that issue anymore. If it's a reaction to an ingredient, he still may react. And at that point, I would then switch him to another agent.
Okay, Michelle, you may have stumped me. She says, how can I increase my saliva pH? I almost always test at 6.4 to 6.6, which seems too acidic. I eat lots and lots of vegetables, but also eat quite a bit of protein. I don't regularly drink apple cider vinegar or eat a ton of citrus. My dentist recently commented that I have evidence of acidic erosion on my enamel. So a few things come to mind, and I definitely want to hear what Anne has to say. Evidence of acidic erosion on my enamel makes me think reflux immediately, even silent reflux that you may not even be aware of that you're having. It's not uncommon for people with reflux GERD their only complaint is that their teeth hurt. Right. So certainly if that's coming up at night and you're not even aware of it, that could be eroding the enamel on your teeth. I don't know that we're worried about the pH of your saliva. I'm definitely interested to hear what Anne has to say about that.
Well, apple cider vinegar is pretty acidic too. And so if that's coming in contact with your teeth, that could also, what?
She said she doesn't drink it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I read that she does. Okay. So I'm in total agreement with Ellen. I would do an H. pylori test and just, you know, see if that's what's going on. And you know, do you tolerate HCl? That would be the other question there. I am not a fan of the oral pH test. There's so many things that can factor into that. And I've done experiments with, when I taught for NTA for many, many years, where I would just have people chew up parsley and an hour later check their pH and it would be completely different. So it's not one that I trust. It can be based on essential fatty acids. It can be based on, dietary things. It's just not all that valuable. Katrina says, could you talk about how you personally set up your practice in terms of packages? I think we've covered that. I'm considering restructuring, would love some more ideas. So Katrina, if there's something more specific based on what we've already said, please go ahead and queue that up in the Q&A box if we didn't answer your question.
Stephanie, this is coming back to her question about her blood labs. Who do you recommend I work with to figure out my blood labs? Can I get contact info? I've already done a GI map and nothing showed up for pathogens. You know, anyone who's a graduate through level 3 is somebody that you could work with. And you also,
Stephanie, I recommend you work with Ellen. Ellen's the best.
Thanks, because I couldn't say it. But yes, you can certainly do a mentoring appointment. Reach out. It's Ellen at restorativewellnesssolutions.com and we'll figure something out, Stephanie.
Perfect. Molly says, parasite protocol, full moon. Could you clarify parasite protocol? There was some discrepancy on the GI Healing Solutions protocol document and the Q&A doc. It sounds like the GI Healing Solutions document is the most up-to-date. It states, important, GI Microbax, Wormwood Complex, and Interface Plus must be pulsed or rotated 10 days on, 7 days off for 4 rounds of therapy, at least 68 days. Continue all other supports for the duration of the protocol. Wait 1 month before testing. How would you alter this to pulse around the full moon?
I think the question in the Q&A document has to do with pulsing around the full moon. And I think that's where Molly's confusion comes in, I think.
The Q&A document being like the FAQ?
Yeah, that, sorry. Okay.
All right, yeah. So just to clarify up front, Molly, when you say parasite, we're talking about nematodes or worms, not the amoeba type, you know, parasites. So first of all, we don't do this protocol for anything other than nematodes or parasites. And I would just base the protocol on having the full moon be, you know, around the pulsing. Like you just like plan it that way. That's all I can think of. Ellen, would you add something different?
No, I think what I've done in the past is done the protocol the way that you've written it here, Molly, which is in the Healing Solutions. And then I have had people even after retesting, sometimes for up to 6 months, do it for a few days around the full moon, right? Just to make sure that they've wiped everything out. So it's not totally necessary, but sometimes you get some of these really stubborn pathogens and that's the way to do it. I would, and I think we had talked about this on Facebook, Molly, I would just go with what's in the Healing Solutions.
Yeah, definitely. And I've had clients that with this protocol, pulsing it, have felt that after the 4 rounds that they still feel like they have parasites. So we would even go like even an extra round. There's nothing wrong with doing that if you need to.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Marquetta says, I have a new client whose main concern is alopecia. Just got her GI map results back. I'm still waiting for her MRT that shows an imbalanced microbiome, 2 strains of dysbiotic bacteria, and lots of weeds, plus 2 potential autoimmune triggers. Also, elevated H. pylori and the protozoa cyclospora, although not marked as high. I'll be addressing the dysbiotic bacteria overgrowth, but not sure if I should be also addressing the H. pylori and the cyclospora. Considering the alopecia and the studies I found linking alopecia with H. pylori and parasites, I'd say it should be dealt with. Would love to know your thoughts. Thank you. I think you've answered your own question here. Yeah, totally. I mean, first of all, let's just say this. H. pylori, we work north to south, top to bottom. If it's there, you have to deal with it, even as a first phase, potentially, before you go on to deal with everything else, if your client wants to go sort of slowly, because you're never going to get the absorption and the nutrients to where they need to be with that H. pylori there. So absolutely. You know, alopecia is autoimmune. You got to clean up the gut. The MRT is going to be super important. Realize also that, you know, we talk a lot in restorative wellness about how things with the skin can be some of the longest term healing things that we see, and alopecia being the hair. You know, you're going to do all the right things, and I just don't know that there's any guarantees with something like alopecia.
Agree completely. Yeah, it's really tough. Anne says, I have a client who that is experiencing a lot of gas. He's going through renal failure and refused all medical interventions, so he's nearing the end stage of life. Is there something that you can recommend to ease the discomfort of the gas? Anne, I'm so sorry. That's a really difficult situation. I would say try some HCL and some enzymes. You know, that would be my number one choice without putting him through any testing or anything like that. It could be that he's just really having a difficult time breaking the food down, and that could really help, or some beta TCP. So I would try those and see, especially the enzymes. That's like first of mind to me, and see if that's helpful. And I hope he can get comfortable.
Yeah, that's really, really hard. Okay, Mary Jane says, what would you say is a reasonable amount of time to spend per month or per year on continuing education? I like this question. I don't know that I'm going to be able to say that it's reasonable, but I can sort of tell you what I do. You know, there's this idea of how much time do you spend working in your business and how much time do you spend working on your business. And I think for our business, continuing education is a very big part of our business, and you have to be sure that you're spending time working on it as well. You know, I think this is something that we probably all struggle with a little bit, because we all want to do everything. We want to take all the courses and listen to all the webinars and read all of the books. And, you know, I think you have to just figure out what's able to work well into your practice. But I think it has to be something that you are thinking about every week. You know, there has to be some sort of little niche of time that you've carved out, that you've set aside every week, that's something for you and for your continuing education. Anne and Margaret laugh at me, but every 4 weeks when I get my nails done, I sit there for almost 3 hours and I listen to webinars, and then I'm emailing them after these 3 hours. So, you know, that's one thing that's set aside that's sacred for me in that time. But I also am going through a couple of online continuing education courses as well, and I try to carve out a couple of hours each week to contribute to that. And it can be hard, because sometimes that's the first thing that you want to cross off your calendar and put in a client or something like that. But I think it's just so important. What do you think, Anne?
Well, you know, it's hard for me, because I have taken so many continuing education classes in the last 20 years that there are very few anymore that pique my interest. But I will say that this year, I spent about $1,500 and I took some really in-depth classes this year. Having done that this year, there's really nothing on the horizon for me that I'm super interested in doing. So, you know, I think it just depends on where you are and what you want to learn more about. And, you know, I definitely think doing that, I mean, I just have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of clinical education. So I think I'm in a different category. Felicia says, I have a client with psoriasis and she's currently on a protocol for digestive healing. Shall I be concerned in regards to her thyroid levels getting checked by the doctor? I'm not qualified to do this. She's in the beginning of her protocol, or shall I wait until she finishes her protocol? So I'm not sure. I mean, I think that it's always an appropriate time to get a blood panel and just do a regular check on things. I don't necessarily think of psoriasis being connected to the thyroid. But if she's concerned about her thyroid, then I think there's no reason not to do it while she's on the protocol.
Okay, let's see. We're almost at the end here. Stephanie asked for clarification. Anne and Margaret do business coaching too. Yes, that's the only mentoring that Anne and Margaret now do. You can book with them for business and strategy and that type of coaching. And I'm doing level 1 through 3 clinical mentoring, and Natalie and Sarah are doing level 1 clinical mentoring at this point. Let's see.
So Grace says, thank you for confirming her analysis. Just to confirm, is it normal to see higher blood glucose levels using broad spectrum panel in pregnant women? I would say no, Grace, that isn't normal. It might be common, but it's not normal. So I would always be looking at the diet. I would always be looking at their mouth and assessing their gums for gingivitis. I mean, that is a clear sign that they're eating way too many starchy carbohydrates. So you can kind of correlate blood sugar by looking for pregnancy gingivitis at the same time.
Okay, let's see. That's just a comment. I think we're there. 5 o'clock.
I think we are. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for your great, great questions. Thank you for being with us tonight. And please join us for our next presentation, which is Alan. And what's the date on that, Alan?
It's next Wednesday, the 15th, at noon. And I think it's going to be fun.
All right. See you there. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Bye.